So it's really important for us, before we begin the presentation, to emphasize the importance of seeing us as human beings. We are being identified as not as a human beings, but as numbers, mostly. So I'm going to let Arij start the presentation, and hopefully you will not be bored 5 minutes ago.
Later,
yeah.
So we're here on the Right to Education tour. This tour brings Palestinians to university students from all over Palestine, and they give them the chance to meet with university students across the states. A specific thing that we focus on is how is our life, how is our educational life under occupation. The main aims of this campaign is first to document and raise awareness of the issues facing Palestinian education, to build international campaign in support and solidarity of Palestine, and to try to oppose the illegal Israeli occupation and its attack on Palestinian education. And finally, to call for action, which is the most important reason why we are here today in front of you. Why we are here in specific, we are here to share the Palestinian narrative with you, because you might hear a lot of things in the news about Palestine and Israel and about the conflict and about the occupation, but I'm very sure that you never got the chance to hear a Palestinian story and Palestinian struggle from a real Palestinian person who's talking with you face to face. I'd like to start with a couple of rights that were a bit nervous in all of your faces. All right, so in 1948, it was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It is when Israel, it is the word, I'll say it again, violated. That's the word. Okay. So in 1948, Israel violated the first human rights of the rights of the Palestinians, because in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 26A said that everyone has the right to education. And as I will go through my presentation, you will find that many villages, cities, and many places in Palestine are still deprived from their right to education. Mm-hmm. In the 1949 Fourth Geneva Convention, the Article 49 said, "The occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies." In other words, Israel should not be moving its own citizens to the land of the Palestinians, because this is illegal. But of course, this is what Israel tries to do each day. It tries to raise number of Israelis who inhabit Palestine so that it can prove itself as the highest power and the biggest number of citizens living on the land. And this, of course, happens on the rights and of the Palestinian people, because these Israelis come and take place of Palestinian people who belong to this land and who have lived there for hundreds of years. All right, now I want to share with you this with you, because according to the UN, there are 4 A's that prove that you have a right to education. The 4 A's are first, adaptable, accessible, available, and acceptable. Now, of course, in Palestine, none of these exist, because our education is not acceptable, because it is not relevant. As I will talk in the presentation, you will see how Israel tries to change the Palestinian curricula so that it will not include anything that supports Palestinians or their cause. It tries to censor these books so that it can change the history of our people by controlling the minds of the little kids who are still in school. Education should be available, which, as I just said, education in Palestine is not available everywhere, because Israel demolishes many, many schools and restricts the activities and the existing schools does. Therefore, education is not available everyone in Palestine. If it's not available, that makes it not accessible, inaccessible, because many villages in Palestine, Israel denies the right to many villages in Palestine to build their own schools. So they have to travel, they have to make very long trips to receive their education, which makes it inaccessible to them. Therefore, we have a high dropout rate of schools. And, of course, it has to be adaptable to the specific needs of the children and to the local context and the changing of the needs of society, which does not exist in Palestine.
I'm sorry, I didn't know, but so the Ministry of Education in Israel is the one that controls, and also controls the curricula?
The curricula, yes, we will talk about that, don't worry. Sundas will tell you a little bit about the history of Palestine, and then we will go.
So in order to talk about the effect of occupation on our education, we have to go back to the roots of the struggle of Palestinians. It started not in 1948, as most people know, or 1967, but it started in 1917 when we were, as Palestinians, Palestine was under the British mandate. And in 1917, Balfour has declared, in the Declaration of Balfour, he gave the land with no people for the people with no land, claiming that Palestine or Palestinians don't exist. Therefore, the immigrations from Zionists from all over the world started to go to Palestine. During the next slides, check on the dots, the black dots in Palestine. The immigration from Zionists came, and because we are already under the British mandate, so it was really easier for the Zionists to have access to land because they can confiscate land under the with the easing of the British mandate. So more and more of the Palestinian lands and more of the exile of the Palestinian families who were living in now called Israel, it happened until 1948, when the big catastrophe of Palestinians happened, where 800,000 Palestinians were exiled from their homelands. So if, after the 1948, that's the, until the 60s, that's the map of Palestine. So this is the West Bank, and this is Gaza. And that's the, ladies and gentlemen, that's the state of Palestine. So where there's no link between this and this, and it's yet called the state of Palestine, and all of this black is the state of Israel built on the confiscated lands of Palestinians who were exiled in 1948. So we are not here to talk about politics, of course, but everything in our lives as Palestinians have been because of that policy and politicians and what happened in back in that time. So we're gonna today we're gonna talk emphasize on the effect of that story on our education as Palestinians. Yeah, this is a map that shows the loss of land for Palestinians. Palestinian state now is declared on the borders of 1967, where 23% of the historical Palestine belongs to Palestinians who live and the state of Palestine, but actually we live on 16% only, and that's the green dots here. Why is that? Because the settlements are being built on the lands of on the West Bank, the confiscated lands on the West Bank. In order to start to reflect what I just explained on our education, I'm gonna talk about the campaign that we represent now and the education cause in Palestine. So the Right to Education campaign actually started in Beer Zeit University back in 1988 when it was the first uprising, the first intifada in Palestine. And at that time, Beer Zeit University was actually started as elementary school, and in 1974 it transferred to a college, a university. Since 1974 until 1988, it has been closed for 14 times by military order from the occupation, meaning that we have a world record in the time of closure. So, yeah. So, in 1988, it was the first uprising in Palestine. And at that time, there was a military order from the Israeli occupation to close all the universities and schools in Palestine, including Beer Zeit University, where it was closed for more than four consecutive years. And imagine not going to school for 4 years, even holding a book, and in your way to the university, you can be threatened of being imprisoned by the Israeli soldiers. So, at that, to make the situation worse, there was this law that says if there was more than 10 people in the room, more than 10 Palestinian people in the room, they will be jailed because that type of gathering is not allowed, especially for students. So imagine, if now we are more than 30 people. So we all will be in jail, like if we were living at that time. You are two professors, right? For you to give a class where for 30 people or 40 people, that is not acceptable at that time for the Israeli occupation. So what happened is students were divided themselves to 10 or 9 students, and they were they used to go to the house of the professor or gather at the house of one student and then have the lecture, then divide themselves again to another 9 students and give them the lecture, and that's how they had their classes and graduated for the 4 years. And at that time, a group of academics and students felt that the right to education is now being attacked by the Israeli occupation, so they need to defend it. So the right to education campaign started to defend the right to education for hundreds and thousands of Palestinians at that time in the schools and universities who couldn't obtain their education because the occupation. We're going to talk more and more about the obstacles and the effects of the occupation on the education. But first, I'm going to talk about at Bir Zeit University. Sorry to mention Bir Zeit a lot, but it's not that it's the only university, but because it's an example of what is happening, what was happening at that time. For example, in 2001 till 2003, it was the second uprising in Palestine. Then the second uprising, there was no laws that says, oh, let's ban the education, let's close the schools and stuff. It's not like the first uprising. But also, education was indirectly banned for Palestinians by building checkpoints and roadblocks between the Palestinian cities, and also by building the apartheid wall, which started in 2002, confiscating more and more of the Palestinian lands and making the roads even worse for Palestinians to have access to the universities. As you can see in this photo, the checkpoint was built, this is called a Surda checkpoint. So this was built between to separate Ramallah from the south. And my university is built in the south of Ramallah. So to put this checkpoint here, like all the Palestinians who are living in Ramallah and the students who are living in Ramallah, and let's say in the areas near Ramallah, they couldn't have access to the university because of that. So they used to walk for 14 kilometers to reach the university for like an 8 a.m. class. Let's say that's type of crazy thing. Like we can't have a natural 8 a.m. class by car, or we're not like we don't like 8 a.m. class basically. And to walk through that, imagine like schools where like university most of the week it was closed because most of the students couldn't have access. And if it was open, then it will be like when the students arrive, we will gather together and have our class. So there was like no regular classes at that time. How long do you wait? Okay, so basically now there's no Surda checkpoint. They removed the checkpoint in 2006. But for 3 years or so, like they have like, depending on the mood of the soldiers that are standing on the checkpoint, they either let the students go through the checkpoint or not. If they got entry to the checkpoint, they have to walk for 14 kilometers to get to school. They can be wait for like hours or maybe half an hour, it depends. But there is a documentary film that the campaign, that the right to education campaign is called Caged Bird Song, and it's basically about that time, about the Surda checkpoint and how the students were banned from entry to their university. So you can it's on YouTube. I'm gonna let Arish start with the detail. Now it's detail, so please don't be bored. So we're gonna start with the effects of the direct effects of the Israeli occupation on education.
Before going into the effects of the occupation and the wall on the educational process, I would just like to talk a little bit about the West Bank. So basically, this is part of the 16% of the land that we own. And even on the 16% of the land, these blue dots are illegal Israeli settlements, which means that Israelis are given houses within the 16% of the land that we own. So even these 16% that were given to us, Israelis still reside in it. There are more than 500,000 settlers who reside inside the West Bank. So imagine trying to build a community of Palestinians if you have 500,000 settlers who live among you. And these Israelis do not come and live in different neighborhoods or different streets than Palestinians. For example, in Hebron, if you go, it's a city in the West Bank, Israelis came and they took over houses of Palestinians in the old city. These houses, if you walk into the old city of Hebron, you have buildings on your right and left, and they are very tall buildings. So usually the situation is that you will find the first two floors of these buildings belonging to Palestinian families, and the upper floors will belong to Israeli families. So as you walk through the old city, you will notice that if you raise your head, you will notice that there's a kind of a siege that is separating the first two floors from the upper floors. If you ask about that siege, you will find that Palestinians helped and raised money to put the siege so that because Israelis from the upper floors used to throw the garbage of the house and the diapers of their babies on the houses of the Palestinians. So Palestinians had to raise the money in order to put this barrier between themselves and the houses of the Palestinians. So imagine having 500,000 people living in your same building, taking over your neighbor's house and coming and doing this to you in your own land and in your own home. The West Bank is one story. Jerusalem is another story. You have Jerusalem is, of course, according to Israel, is the state of Israel. So you have more than 400,000 settlers who reside in Jerusalem on its own. So this is a map of the wall. I'm sure you guys all know about the apartheid wall. The pink line is the area where the pink line is the area where the wall is supposed to be built on. The blue one is where it will be built if they continue, and of course they are continuing its construction. Now this wall, as Israel claims, is built on lands that are next to the West Bank area, on lands that do not belong to farmers and people who live in the West Bank area. But of course this claim is wrong, because 46% of the wall is built on lands of Palestinians who live in Palestine, and on lands of farmers who the land used to be their only source of income. Imagine a farmer whose only source of income is the land. Israelis come and they confiscate his land. And of course, the separation wall is not built in areas that are isolated from the people or anything. 2 minutes away from my house, I find the separation house separating two neighbors from each other. Imagine, so neighbors used to cross the street to meet each other every day. And right now, the separation walls go through the street, and if the neighbors want to reach each other, they would have to make a 2-hour trip just in order to cross the street. So imagine the kind of restriction of movement that Israel wants to put Palestinians through. To be exact, 78 villages with a total population of more than 200,000 will be completely isolated if the construction continues, because as you can see in these photos, the wall spreads around the village, isolating it from anything around it. So the village will be completely isolated and completely closed. No one will be allowed to go out, or no one will be allowed to come in. All right, now, there are more than 500 roadblocks and military checkpoints in the West Bank. So if you were to enter or leave an area or a city that is a part of the West Bank, you would have to spend hours on that checkpoint. I would like now to give you a lesson about the Palestinian life 101, if you may. Palestinians, basically, you can refer to a Palestinian as a blue or a green. Well, it's funny, right? Because in Palestine, my name is not Erij, my name is Blue, all right? And Sundus's name is not Sundus, her name is Green. So basically, I have a blue ID because I live in Jerusalem. This blue ID allows me to travel anywhere I want in Palestine, and I'm allowed to enter the West Bank and leave the West Bank. But Sundus's case is different. Sundus has a green ID, which is an ID issued by the Palestinian government. This ID is issued by the Israeli government. If you have a green ID, it's bad. It's very bad. If you have a green ID, you're only allowed to live in the 16%. Can you go to another? Yeah, you're only that would be fine. Yeah, you're only allowed to live in this small area, which, if you remember the big map, this is the small blue area that was left. This is this area without this. This is Gaza. Gaza is another story. We don't want to go there. So if you have a green ID, you're only allowed to stay in this area. You're not allowed to enter Jerusalem or the lands of the 48 unless you obtain a permit. Now, a permit can only be issued by the Israeli authorities, and it's basically never issued. They only issue you a passport if you have a serious medical condition or you need immediate healthcare, or if it's the Islamic or Christian holiday. And even on those two occasions, sometimes you are denied a permit, and many Palestinians are still waiting for medical treatment in Jerusalem because Israel is refusing to issue them a permit to enter Jerusalem. So this is the green ID. Because I have the blue ID, I live in Jerusalem, but I study in Bethlehem, which is a part of the West Bank. So Bethlehem and Jerusalem are two cities that are 20 minutes apart, but because there is a checkpoint at the entrance of Bethlehem, this is Bethlehem, because there's a checkpoint at the entrance of Bethlehem, the road that is usually 20 minutes, that can take you 20 minutes, takes you up to 2 hours. So I go to school by bus, and when I try to enter Bethlehem, of course I am asked to step down from the bus only because I'm a Palestinian. I am physically searched. This is, I'm talking about something that daily happens on a daily basis. I'm asked to step down from the bus. My bag is taken and searched as well. I am asked questions by a soldier who is maximum 19 years old. Imagine being grilled with questions every day on a daily basis. Questions about what do you study, where do you go, where are you coming from, what does your dad do, what does your mom do? All these sorts of questions that this soldier standing in front of me has absolutely no right in knowing, and he probably only came to the country 2 or 3 months ago, and he's asking me, a Palestinian who have been here in this land for 22 years, and before me my grandparents and grand-grandparents have been here on this land for more than I did. Imagine being asked all sorts of questions by someone who does not belong to this land. Imagine how does this make me feel. So as I just said, there are many physical effects. It's hard to reach schools, division of Palestinian areas, inspection of students, the risk of being arrested. Many of my university colleagues were arrested because they simply participated in peaceful demonstrations against the apartheid wall and against the occupation in general. Now, being a Jerusalemite does not end by obtaining this ID. This is not a good ID, because even if you have the blue ID and you're considered a resident of Israel, you are never considered a full citizen of Israel simply because you're a Palestinian. This ID has an expiration date, and when my ID expires, if I go to renew it, at any point Israel can refuse to renew my ID, and that simply means that I have to move from Jerusalem, and I'm not allowed to stay in my house in Jerusalem anymore. That's why they have an expiration date on IDs. Imagine like being a temporary citizen or something like that. And even after you obtain this, for example, I live in Jerusalem and I have 4 travel documents on me. So this is my Israeli travel ID. This is my Jordanian passport, but this is my Jordanian something, I don't even know what this is, but I do know that I needed to travel. This means that I'm not a full citizen of Jordan, and this is an Israeli travel document. I know that I needed to travel, but again, I don't know why. So imagine carrying all of these around with you. So usually when I'm at the counter, when I'm traveling in the airport, and the guy asks me, can I have your passport? I'm like, choose which one do you want, Habib, right? Because I have so many. So, yeah. So imagine being a citizen of nowhere. I'm not a full citizen of Jordan, because this card means I'm not a full citizen of Jordan. I'm not a full citizen of the state of Israel, because I don't have an Israeli passport. And I'm not a full citizen of the state of Palestine, because I have nothing that proves that I'm Palestinian, except my own beliefs. I have no document that proves that I am Palestinian. So this is the kind of hardships that Palestinians who live in Jerusalem in specific go through each day. And I'd like to mention one last thing. If someone who holds this ID was to get in a relationship or marry someone who holds a green ID, it means they would have to compromise their own ID and they would have to move to the West Bank, because people with different color IDs are not allowed to marry. So if you were to marry someone from the West Bank, you'd either live in separate houses, like you'd basically be marrying a divorce. So, yeah. Some people try to appeal so that they can bring their spouse to live with them in Jerusalem, but on very rare cases, Israel accepts that. So it ends up with a real divorce, because things simply do not work out. Or they end up living in separate houses, and the kids have to commute each day from the mother's house to the father's house. So marrying someone from the West Bank would mean that you would have to let go of this Jerusalem ID, and you'd have to move to the West Bank.
So let's just say I was a Palestinian living in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and I wanted to build a house. How much does it cost?
Very good question, actually. So as a Palestinian living in Jerusalem, the salaries in Jerusalem are around, let's say, $2,000, something like that. This is like a maximum. I'm talking about a maximum of $2,000. If you're really lucky, you will get that. If you want to buy a house, and I'm not talking about a villa or anything, I'm talking about a small apartment in a building you share with 20 other people, it can go up to $1 million. So imagine getting paid $2,000 a month and trying to pay back a loan of $1 million. And if you want to build your own house, of course, you need a permit from the Israeli government in order to start building. And this permit costs something else other than the $1 million you already have to pay to build the house. Like almost always, Israel does not issue you a permit. So what Palestinians end up doing, because they have a family to provide to, they have kids who want to put a roof over their heads, right? So they go ahead and start building the house on the hope that Israel will issue them a permit within the next few months. Israel does not issue them a permit. The house ends up being built. And 2 or 3 years later, you're given a note by an Israeli soldier that says you have 1 week to evict your house. Your house is being demolished on Friday the 17th on 1 a.m., let's say. So in 1 week, imagine having to leave your house and the place where you have lived in for sometimes all of your life, sometimes 5 or 6 years. Imagine having to leave and evict that house within 1 week notice. And this has happened to one of my friends and my colleagues who I used to work with. His brother built a whole building for their family so they would stay together and raise their families together. And it was maybe a three-floor building or a four-floor building. And Israel came, gave them 1 week eviction notice. And within 1 week, the bulldozers came. The house was in front of their eyes, demolished on the ground. They had more than 20 kids living in that building. Imagine what will happen to the future of those kids and to the adults living inside the building as well. Okay, so these are some photos I'd like to share with you. This beautiful view is the view I see whenever I leave my university. This is the gate that exists in the apartheid wall. It is open only on rare cases and only to Israeli cars. It is never open to Palestinian cars. And by the way, if you have a Palestinian plate number, you're not allowed to travel to Jerusalem. These are some photos of kids. Imagine having to go through this or this, and you're not even 15. Imagine the fear and the terror on their faces of seeing an Israeli soldier with a rifle that is longer than them. Imagine going through that where you're not even 10 years old. I mean, being 10 means you have to make friends and you have to learn your alphabets and all of that. Imagine what being a 10-year-old kid in Palestine feels like. And this picture is in Gaza after the last war in Gaza. The card says martyr and the name of the martyr. This is not a stage photography. This was the scene, and this photo was not built. these are real kids in school who wanted to honor their friends who lost in the war. So they ended up putting cards next to the seat they used to sit in and writing their name on it and the date they were murdered by Israeli soldiers.
So restriction of movements is type of like the visible violations toward our education in Palestine. You can see it. Like once any one of you comes to Palestine, he or she can see the wall. They can see they might cross the checkpoints, and they will see the arrest of students, the terrifying conditions of people who living in Jerusalem or in Hebron and some areas in the West Bank. But I'm going to talk a bit about the unseen, the invisible violations, which is more dangerous than the visible ones because it controls our minds and our history. And I'm going to talk about the curriculums. The Palestinian curricula is... So in order to connect the curricula with the actual condition, so here's the West Bank and here's Gaza, right? And in 1967, the West Bank was under the control of the Jordanian authority, the Jordanian. So there was a Jordanian curricula that was taught in the Palestinian schools in West Bank. But Gaza was under the control of the Egyptian side, so there was the Egyptian curricula in Gaza. And also in Jerusalem, because it's part of the West Bank at that time, so it was also under the Jordanian curriculum. But what happened since 1994, where an Oslo agreement started and the PA, Palestinian government, was established, we had for the first time as Palestinians to write our own narratives in the textbooks. So before that, there was a little space for us to learn about our histories in the Jordanian and Egyptian curricula. But since 1994, we had that chance to build our own curricula. But unfortunately, the BA doesn't have the money to make the curricula. So where comes the money? The money comes from the foreign aid and the foreign countries. And that is being indirectly pressured by the Israeli occupation to build an anti-Israeli biased textbooks, meaning that even if we had the chance to make our history and geography books, we will have to remove every word that talks about a Nakba, which is the catastrophe that happened in 1948, and refer to it as a war between Arabs and Israelis. So we are not being referred to as Palestinians in our textbooks, and we are in a war. So yeah, we were like we had at that time F-16 in Palestine. So it's 50-50 war it was in 48. Yes, and even in our geography books, we had the whole map. Okay, in our geography books, we are being learned. Oh, that's the map of Palestine. But let's talk a bit about Palestine. So in the north of Palestine, you will find Jenin, which is in the north of the West Bank. Not Al-Jalil, which is in the north of the historical Palestine. And let's talk to the south. Oh, we have Hebron here. Imagine about the coast. Every country has to have a coast, at least. So that's the coast. The Gaza, Rafah, and we are being taught that this is Palestine. So imagine for a little child to learn about Palestine where, oh, this is the whole map, but this is your Palestine here. Okay, if I want to learn about Gaza, I can't cross there. There's no bridge between here and here. If any Gazan student want to come and to see Palestine, there's like only 2 to 3 hours from here to here. But we can never have contact with Palestinians in Gaza. Actually, the only chance we have to interact with Palestinians in Gaza is outside of Palestine. For us, it was like maybe the second time for me, for example, to see someone from Gaza. It was in New York when I landed here to the US. I saw a Palestinian who is from Gaza. He studies in New York. So imagine. It's really easier to see them in New York than see them from Gaza.
actually we're supposed to have our friends with us to do our the presentation with us. He's from Gaza, he's called Mohammed Shah. And Mohammed, he studies in the Islamic University in Gaza, and he was banned from coming here. He has to have 3 permits. A 1-day permit to have his interview and the US consulate to have the visa in Jerusalem, which is 3 hours from Gaza. He was banned there. A 1 permit to get out of Gaza through Erez to come to Palestine and then go to Jordan and fly from Jordan to come here, which he also was banned from having. And another permit to have from the Jordanian side to have to get him the permit from the Israeli side to get out of Gaza. And also he was banned from having it. So imagine the process that he has, he and like 2 million Palestinians who live in Gaza has to go through only just to have control on their movement, and which is the right of anyone. I can't imagine, like you might be like complaining, oh, the traffic. Like there is traffic and I will be late at class, and this is like nothing compared to what we have to face each and every day, because going through the apartheid wall and the checkpoints. And also the siege on Gaza, which made Gaza an open-air prison. So going back to the curricula, I talked about the West Bank and the Gaza curricula. In East Jerusalem, the curricula in the Palestinian schools, or the Arab schools, as the State of Israel says, they are being taught the Palestinian curricula, okay? But that can't be like go easily, because the Palestinian schools in Jerusalem is being controlled by the Ministry of Education in Israel. So all curricula is being censored by the Ministry of Education. So that's our history book for the 11th grade in Jerusalem, where you can see that words are like pages that talks about the second intifada, the first intifada, being erased from the books. Even the logo of the Palestinian Authority, it's in each book. It should be in each book, like that is issued by the Palestinian Authority, deleted from the books that is being taught in Jerusalem, because it has the Palestinian flag. I'm not sure, but Arij, if you can, because if you are from Jerusalem, if you can talk about your experience being taught in schools. Mm-hmm. In Jerusalem.
Of course, I mean, as soon as that being a Jerusalemite and getting your education in Jerusalem is never easy. I remember growing up in 5th and 6th grade and reading my history book, and as I was reading my history book, there were no words that says Palestine or solidarity or being Palestinian from Jerusalem. Basically, anything related to Palestine was erased and censored from these books. So I was confused. I had a conflict. My parents at home were telling me that you're Palestinian, you're a Palestinian from Jerusalem. But at the same time, in my school, in my history class, the name Palestine was never mentioned. And this is not because I studied in an Israeli school. I did not study in an Israeli school. This is because the school system was controlled by the Israeli Authority. So if any teacher or professor were to teach the students about Palestine, they would be punished. They would be sometimes sent to jail even, only for mentioning the word Palestine or Palestinian in a history class or in any other class. Even I mean, you're wearing your kufiya today, right? The Palestinian scarf, al-hatta. I was not allowed to wear that in Jerusalem, because if I got caught in my school or in the streets wearing that, I would be in trouble. I would get punished for it. I was not able to raise my own Palestinian flag in my house, on my roof. The Israelis would constantly be roaming around the streets and checking if anyone raises the flags of Palestine, and those people would be arrested. Only imagine being arrested for raising the flag of your own country. So imagine what it was like receiving your education and growing up knowing that you're a Palestinian, but at the same time you're being taught absolutely nothing about Palestine in your history class, because simply your school is being monitored, every single step is being monitored by Israeli authorities.
Yeah.
You mentioned since 1984, these books have been written, but also from the perspective of Israel. Is it still the same now? The
since 1994, we had the first time to write our own Palestinian textbooks.
And
so that's about this.
I mean, I graduated school like 4 years ago, so this was not too long ago. It's still going on till now.
Yeah.
And it's,
so
it's
this
being
is
done,
now.
It is being done more more accessibly, and it's not getting better, it's getting worse, basically.
Yeah, and so for Palestinians who live in the occupied land in 1948, which is now the state of Israel, they are being taught in separated Arab schools. They have a curriculum that is made not by Palestinian authorities, of course, by the Ministry of Education in Israel. So it's in Arabic, and they try to adapt textbooks to match the students, but of course, they don't ever mention that they are Palestinians. They refer to them as Arabs. Also, they have this mandatory textbooks that is being taught to elementary school, which is called How to Be a Citizen in the State of Israel. Basically, like for what, an example of the lessons in this book is a lesson called Al-Quds Asmat Israel, Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. So it says, oh, how sweet we are. As Israelis, we came to Jerusalem, we brought water, we brought electricity, and healthy, clean streets. So Arabs now, we are really happy in Jerusalem, because now we have lights. We are all happy citizens, because we live in Israel. So yeah, let's sing the Israeli anthem. Nearly 2 million Palestinians who are living in the state of Israel as being referred as Arabs. They are living there, and they are, as also as Arich said, they have the blue ID, and they are being not citizens of Israel, but they are being resident of Israel. Based on Adala, there's this organization called Adala, which is justice for Arabs minority in the state of Israel. It's built by Palestinians who live in the 48. They did this research that says that there are like 50 laws that discriminate between Palestinians who live in the 48 and the Israelis. So they are not being treated as fully citizens, even in the only democratic state in the Arab region. Yeah, quotation. So it says that it was for the fourth and the sixth graders in Haifa. It says that 75% of the children describe Arabs as murderers, and that is in the Israeli schools. The Israeli children were asked about that. Referred as murderers, kidnappers, criminals, and terrorists. 90% of the children stated the Palestinians have no rights whatsoever to the land of Israel or Palestine, so we don't exist.
This survey does not simply include education. This survey means that kids in Israel, I mean, imagine the kind of mentality that these kids will grow as. I mean, grow up to. The IDF, as it is now, is already bad. So imagine kids who are 6 or 7 years old answering these surveys and having these questions. Imagine the kind of mentality, the types and the ideas and the thoughts that these kids will grow up with. They will always think that Arabs and Palestinians are terrorists. They always think that they are the other side who do not belong to this land. So Israel here plays a very important game, deceiving game on the minds of the little kids. Because if you want to change something, you should always start with the little ones, right?
Exactly.
So if you raise up a generation of kids who believe that Palestinians are terrorists, who believe that Palestinians do not belong to this land, if you raise up a generation of Palestinians who were taught nothing about Palestine in their history books. Imagine how these Israeli kids and how these Palestinian kids will grow up to be. It will always be more hate. It will always be a bigger conflict, because simply this side will always think that these are terrorists, and Palestinians will have their own inner conflict, believing that they do not, that there is no land called Palestine. I belong to a land, but this land, it does not exist. This land is not in my history book. So where do I belong to? This is the same inner conflict I had while growing up in my history class, when I knew I belonged to a land called Palestine, but Palestine simply did not exist in my history book. So where did I'm a citizen, but I'm basically a citizen of nowhere.
another violation towards our education is, before I talk about that, how many of you are active in campus, like in groups of movements or? Now you all will be in jail in Palestine. So you're being jailed twice today. Sorry. In Palestine, in the Palestinian universities, basically in the West Bank, Palestinians are being threatened of being in prison, the Israeli prison, only because they are expressing their opinions, political opinions, or even a normal being active on campus. Last year, there has been like the student council in my university. It has 11 people, okay? 9 of them were being arrested directly after the elections. 9 out of 11. So how is the student council is gonna run? It's gonna shut down. This happens occasionally in the Palestinian universities, where, for example, in my university, we have nearly 80 students who are being currently arrested in the Israeli jails. We have now 5,000 Palestinians who are being in jail in the Israeli prisons because they are trying to resist the occupation and the oppression that they are living under. And that's not only like boys. We have more than 30 women inside the Israeli prison who are being jailed only for fighting for their rights or their children's rights. And that's as we believe, is part of the collective punishment that we as Palestinians have to live because we are under occupation. Our university campus has many, many raids from the Israeli army just because the student council is being active. Many universities have been raided, including like my university has been raided twice in the past 2 years. And they basically go in the middle of the night, they raid the campus, bomb the gates of the campus, and bomb the door of the student council building. And they go and confiscate the flag, the posters, the papers. They even, like last time, they even confiscated a whole closet. Like they hold it, the closet, and they run with it. I don't know what you're gonna do with a closet. Like we don't have like one closet in the whole building. We need that closet. So basically, just take whatever you want from it and give it back. So as you can see, like at that level, we are being targeted as Palestinian students only because we are trying to change the reality that we are living in. And to talk about the arrest, not only the effect of arrest, not only on students, but on their families, I'm going to talk a bit about a story of mine. It was back in 2002. It was the second uprising in Palestine. At that time, I was 10 years old. I had a little sister called Shada. She was at that time first grader, so 6 years old. So there was an invasion on Ramallah city, where I live. And I live in a house that is 10 minutes away from a settlement that is built on the West Bank land. It's called Beit Elif. It's one of the biggest settlements on the West Bank. 15 minutes away, there's my school, and it's called Al-Fajr Jalil. At the time of invasion, there was a curfew on the Palestinians. The Palestinian families were banned from going out of their houses for, let's say, 2 days or more, and they are only allowed to get out of their houses for certain hours a day, like, let's say, from 4 to 7 p.m. and only to purchase their essentials and come back. For 1 or 2 weeks, we were banned from getting out of our houses, so there was no school for these 2 weeks. And after a while, there was on the media, the Israelis has declared that the invasion on Ramallah will continue for the next several months. So schools has to open. And the families were really insisting that the students should and their children should go to school. So after a week or two of the curfew, there was the school we got back to school, and we were really anxious because like being 2 weeks at home is like being in jail. Like we can't do anything under the control of our parents. Like we can't play in the house. Don't like be aware of everything because you have to be neat. So after 2 weeks, we were really anxious to go back to school. So I was preparing myself at that time, like for the next day of school. And I remember that I woke up really early the second day, the day of school, to go. So I went to my mom to get my lunch bag. My lunch box. My mom, instead of giving me the lunch box, she gave me 2 onions and 1 lemon. And I was like, oh my God, that's not food. What am I going to do with 2 onions and 1 lemon? She told me, okay, just keep these with you. And when you go back home, just bring your sister from her class, run back home, don't do anything, don't talk to anyone. And after like 15 minutes of the school, you will be at house. So I said, okay, but why the 2 onions? I need food. And she told me, okay, when you go back from school, there will be clashes and demonstrations nearby, near the settlements. So there will be no cars to reach you, return you to the house. So you have to walk, you and your sister. And this 2 onions and 1 lemon to survive tear gas, because there will be tear gas from the demonstration. So yeah, at first I thought, okay, that would be like an action movie where I will be the hero of, and I will like rescue my sister from the tear gas. I will open the onion and to have, and I give it to my sister. She will smell it and oh, we will be fine. So we went to school, and after the school finished, we were at the gate of the school, and it was not normal at all because we could see the tanks and the soldiers standing in front of the school. But we continue walking, and until after 5 minutes of walking, we reached near like 100 meters away from the clashes and the demonstrations. So I thought, okay, since it's like an action movie, I should be the hero and I should like at least look at a peek of what is happening 100 meters away. So I started like watching with my sister. She was with me, and we started watching the demonstration. We could see the young people, Palestinian young people, throwing rocks at the soldiers, and the soldiers are pointing their rifles upon the young Palestinians, and they were throwing tear gas. We could see also a child who was nearly 12 years old was throwing, he has his backpack on his shoulders, and he was also throwing rocks. So we focused on that little child. And he was throwing rocks, and there was this soldier that is pointing the rifle towards him, and he shot him in the leg. And at that time, me and my sister, we just couldn't move, because to see the blood, the amount of blood, and to see the amount of violence in front of us, it was shocking for us. Because here we go, like, it's not an action movie, it's life. Because of that child, like the young people in the demonstration, they got really angry because they shot the child. So they started throwing more and more stones. The soldiers started throwing more and more tear gas. So me and my sister could smell the tear gas, and there was like this huge cloud of tear gas that we were surrounded by, and we shot. I forgot about the 2 onions, 1 lemon. I forgot even that I have a sister with me. It was really scary for us at that time, because I thought that I'm gonna die. Lucky for us, there was this man coming from the demonstration, and he saw us, and he just pushed us out of the cloud of tear gas, and he told us, like, run back home. And we couldn't think of anything but running. And finally, when we got home, we were crying, and we told my mom, okay, we're not gonna go to school. We're not gonna die going to school. This is not worth it, like, to go to have classes and get killed going back home. So my mom, I remember her words as it was yesterday. She told me, the only thing that will change the future that you will have tomorrow, the only thing that will change the reality that you are living now is through your education. So tomorrow you should and you must go to school. There's like this is unquestionable. So at that time I thought that, oh, my mom is being like a bit harsh on us, because like we're not gonna get lucky to have someone who will rescue us. But now I really understand why she's saying that. Because we were forced as Palestinian children to be grown and have responsibility more than any child in the world could carry. So after that incident, there was summer break, and there was the Eid was really the Islamic holiday, Al-Eid. So we, as little children, we were really happy to have Eid, because it was like our chance to play and to forget about what we saw at each day going to school. So what happened is that we had this tradition in our family that my dad comes early back from work a day before the Eid, and here we go with him and we buy a new clothes and new toys and stuff. So at that day, my dad didn't show up. And we thought, okay, he's gonna be late at work or something. So my mom took us and we got our stuff and got back home, and we slept like babies, feeling like really anxious for tomorrow that will be Eid and we will forget about the occupation. We will just play as little children. I remember that I woke up that night at nearly dawn, and I was really anxious for like going to my mom and dad and say Happy Eid, and like wake up until it's the prayer time and start playing with the children. And so I was searching in the house for my dad. I couldn't find him, and my mom, I couldn't find her, and I kept like searching, and my mom was on the balcony window watching the street. She was waiting for any car to pass by in the street, and that car, by any chance, my dad will be in it. So I waited with her. My dad wasn't there. We kept waiting until it was a sunrise, and my dad also didn't show up. So my mom told me, she just looked at me and she told me, okay, so your dad must be dead or something, because he can never not to come to Eid and be with you. So let's call your uncles. And see, she started calling my uncles, and they came and they started searching for him. And they called the police, the hospitals, everything, and they couldn't find him. After a while, they found his car. He wasn't in the car. At the end of the day, they found out that from a policeman, the Palestinian policeman, that my father is being arrested in the Israeli jails. He was arrested going back home. I didn't understand what is the meaning of arrest at that time. I was so little to understand what does that mean. So I thought that arrested means that, okay, he will be with us maybe this weekend. Unfortunately, my dad was investigated for 90 days. And for 60 days of those 90 days, he was denied access to a lawyer. And in these 3 months, we couldn't see my father. We couldn't visit him. Even my mom and the lawyer couldn't visit him. He was investigated with no evidence. At that time, when he was arrested, we didn't know anything about him, and imagine the fear that we had, because we have no father in the house, and it was also the invasion, and we still live near the settlement, so we could hear the clashes and the sound of bullets and bombs, and we were like really scared each day. We were like going through that. So my mom, after a while, she stopped saying to us like, oh, you will be safe, don't worry, and hug us and stuff, because like that didn't work. So what she did is like she built us a tent under the bed. So she had this sheets, the sheets of the bed, and she built us a tent, and she made us like sleep under the bed for the next 3 or 4 weeks because she said, oh, this is your safe place. And we felt that it's a safe place because it was the sound was a bit lower and we could like have our own world under the bed. And so for the next 3 or 4 weeks, we stayed under the bed. But also at that time, we really needed my father at the most needed time to have a father. And now when I remember all what I had to suffer when I was a little kid, 10 years old, and for my sister, when she was like only 6 years old, to go all through that, I remember that now there are 7,000 Palestinians who are being imprisoned in the Israeli prisons. We have 400 Palestinian child who are being in prison, the Israeli prison. We have now more than 30 women that are being missed by their families and their children in the Israeli prison. We have hundreds of Palestinians who are being jailed under administrative detention, where the Israeli can arrest them for no evidence. For under a secret file, like no one knows, even the lawyer of the Palestinian prisoners can't have access to that file because it's secret. Only the judge can have access to that file, and only him can sentence the Palestinian prisoner a sentence for 3 months or 6 months, and it's renewable. So imagine all that and what we have to suffer, not only on a basic like day, but the kind of trauma that the Palestinians have to face each day. We became detached from our feelings. Mm-hmm. Mostly that also affects not us as Palestinians who are trying to develop ourselves and live as human beings, but also imagine the kind of education that the children will get when going to school and thinking about, oh, their father or mother being in jail, or what is happening through going through the checkpoint, going to school, or that the settler can and at any time can go to their house now. I'm sure that you know about Ahmed Manasser. I don't know if you know about him. Ahmed Manasser, he's a 14-year-old child, where he was walking with his cousin near a settlement, going back home, and he was shot, he and his cousin. His cousin was killed, and he was, they let him, there's a video like on the social media about it. They let him, like his blood were, شُمَعْنَا صَفَّ دَمُّ. Yeah, his blood was in the floor. He was like asking for help. 14 years old child. The settler has his camera and he was like shooting, like having a picture of this child being killed. He was asking for help and he was like, they were like naming him, curse him in many bad names only because he's Palestinian. And they, after that, like the ambulance came and they didn't immediately got him to an ambulance. Like they let him for a half an hour, then let the ambulance to come and pick him. And now he's still in jail. He's 14 years old and they keep postponing his court until he is being 16 so they can sentence him a higher charge because they are not allowed to charge him under the age of 14. There are many, many kids like Ahmed Manasra, and it can go to, like, there are many, many stories, like millions, not millions, alhamdulillah. Sorry, but there are like hundreds of stories for Palestinians who face like that, face something like this. I'm sure that you heard about the Dawabsha family. Mm-hmm. The Dawabsha family, where in the middle of the night, the settlers came to this village near Nablus city called Douma, and they burned the whole house where the family were sleeping, and they were burned alive. Only one child survived. His name is Ahmed Dawabsha. He's 5 years old. Ahmed is 5 years old. his mother and father and 1 year old baby was killed, and they were burned alive. And now he only, the only family that he has is his grandfather and grandmother and his aunt, aunties and uncles. So, and like until now, the settlers that burned the house, they are not being sentenced. Yeah, imagine that. And you, I know that you know about Mohammed Khdair, who the child, the 14 years old child that was burned alive also by settlers, and they like burned his body. They made scars on his body after he was like burned alive. And until now, the settlers did that to him. Until now, they are being sentenced like for 6 years or 3 years. And the family of Muhammad keeps asking for appeal because they think that this is injustice for their child. So yeah, we went away from education, but not far away from that, because going to school thinking about that amount of hate that being and oppression that is being put on Palestinians, children, women, elders, and like young men and men, our daily life is to survive occupation. Mm-hmm. But we are done from surviving the occupation, and we need to end it. So today we are here to ask you help us ending the occupation and getting our right to education, because it's the best tool that we have to resist the occupation. And because once we are educated and we have the right to education, we have access to all other rights, including our right to be free. Yeah, so now Gaza, and I'm gonna let Arish talk about the whole other story.
Yeah, I think that's... thank you, Sindus, for that. I think it's only fair that Gaza has a small part of our presentation today. We will not go very deep into the story of Gaza because you don't want to stay here for 5 hours more, right? So... basically, Gaza has been raided 3 times since 2007, which means that if you think about it, kids who are now 10 years old, they have already been through 3 wars in their lifetime. Imagine being 10-year-old and already going through 3 wars and 3 traumatizing wars. Yani not anything very simple or anything. 3 wars where one of them. Gaza was raided in tanks and people were being killed in the streets. So imagine, first of all, imagine going through all of that only at the age of 10. Of course, this affects the educational process in Gaza because the war in 2014, 100 schools were damaged and in need of repair. So imagine the amount of kids. You have 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. 100 schools means that more than 100,000 kids were displaced and were did not receive the right to education in that war. Moreover, in the 2008 war, 280 schools were bombed, and 18 were completely destroyed. So imagine trying to build a community, to build Gaza, and each and every year you have to start from scratch again. You have to go back to square one because every couple of years you have to be raided by the Israeli army, and it simply brings you back to square one. You cannot imagine the kind of damage and the kind of physical, emotional, and more damages that these raids have on Palestinians. When we were in New York before we came here, we met someone from Gaza, as soon as was said. And as we were talking, we were talking about the war he lived in 2014. You cannot imagine how our friend still remembers the exact tiny little details about the war. He remembers the voice of the person who called his father, telling him that you have 15 minutes to evict this building because we are going to bomb it in 15 minutes. So as he was describing it, he said this was one of the tallest buildings in Gaza. and hundreds of families lived there. So no one believed this phone call. No one believed my dad when he went out to the street and said, please, everyone, evict the building, because I just received a phone call from an IDF soldier telling me that we're about to bomb the building, evacuate it. And again, I'm quoting everything that person, our friend, said. 5 minutes later, the soldier called again, and he said, you now have 10 minutes to evict your house. Everyone was panicking. Everyone, imagine hundreds of families living in this very tall building and being given 10 minutes to evacuate the house that you probably have lived in through your whole life. So everyone was running into the streets. Everyone was screaming, and this is his own description. And the word that did not leave my mind when I spoke to him is that he described that day as Judgment Day. Imagine the kind of impact that they had on him. He told me, I felt it was Judgment Day. Everyone was running, women, kids in the streets. Everyone was running in opposite directions. No one knew anyone. Even families were separated because everyone simply wanted to leave the building and get away from it as far as possible. So imagine the kind of trauma that all of these kids and all of these families will suffer from after seeing their houses bombed in front of their house, in front of their eyes. This is a university in Gaza that probably has hundreds of and thousands of students, and it's now completely damaged and cannot be used. These are all schools. This is a school, the American International School in Gaza. So they're even bombing places that under international law they cannot bomb, like UN schools, like hospitals, like mosques. Every one of those buildings was bombed. Imagine how many laws are they violating by doing this. These are very simple facts about Israel. Israel does not only control education. It goes to borders, seacoast, import, electricity, water, exports, and everything else. This is under international law. Gaza is still occupied. Israel keeps saying that they have they are not occupying Gaza anymore because the war ended, but no, it's still being occupied. If you're still controlling each one of these factors, how can you stand and say in an international conference that you have ended your occupation on Gaza? These are very basic needs that Gazans are being deprived of. Power, you don't have power from 12 to 16 hours a day. Our friend was telling us the other day that they only had electricity for 4 hours a day. And when electricity comes, it's like Christmas in Gaza. Everyone runs on the streets and tries to charge their laptop, their phone, and everything so they can survive the other 16 hours that they will spend without electricity. And imagine people whose lives depend on machines and on electricity. Imagine what happens to those people in Gaza. 40% of the population receives 5 to 8 hours of water only every 3 days. Imagine having no water in your house. What will that do to you? And even the water you get, 90 to 95% of it is unfit for drinking. 100,000 families were displaced, 50% shortage in cooking gas. Is Gaza in 2020 going to be a livable place? This is very questionable right now. I did not want to go into details because I said the topic of Gaza needs a presentation on its own. It cannot be discussed as quickly, but I just wanted to make it clear that Gaza is still a part of Palestine, even though that Israel tries to isolate it from other Palestinians, so we will have no affiliation with it whatsoever. We will forget about it. We will forget that it's a part of Palestine. But Gaza is still suffering as well. And more than the rest of Palestinians as well. So it's very important that we remember our suffering, their suffering with us today. Sandas wants to talk a little bit about the administrative detention in Palestine as well.
So I explained a bit about the administrative detention, but because it's a really important subject, I'm gonna talk more details about it, since we, I don't know if you heard about the Palestinian prisoners who are being in hunger strikes. They were like under hunger strike because of the administrative detention. They will be jailed with no trial, with no access for a lawyer, that up to 90 days, they can ban you from having access to a lawyer. and with no evidence, and under a secret file that only the judge can have a look at it. Even your lawyer can't know the evidence or the secret file. Currently, there are hundreds of Palestinians who are being under administrative detention. And these Palestinians, they suffer from, like, imagine having hope that you will be released, like, if you were under this type of detention, and you have a hope to be released in 6 months after your sentence is being, is like, ended. And right after you finish your sentence, they will tell you, oh, but we will renew it. And you will be like in another, for another 6 months, be detained in the Israeli jails. There are currently like some Palestinians in the Israeli prisons who are being 10 years held in the Israeli prisons under administrative detention. Imagine like every 3 or 4 or 6 months they come up and tell you at the gate of your liberty. And they will tell you, oh, but we will renew your sentence. So for the next 6 months, you will be in the Israeli jails. They can ban the Palestinian prisoners from seeing their families. First of all, like only first relative, like first level of relatives, like your mother, father, and your siblings, if you are a Palestinian prisoner, these are the people who can visit you. And they can visit you once a month, but the actual thing that they might not visit you for 5 or 6 months because simply they can't give a permit for, like, in order also to visit you you need to have a permit. They can deny one of the members from having a permit, or they can punish the prisoner by denying him from seeing his family. Also, the Red Cross, because only the Red Cross can visit the prisoners occasionally and make some statistics and some research about their conditions in the Israeli prison. But also, the Red Cross can sometimes be banned from visiting these prisoners. So more than 600 prisoners were detained only from Jerusalem in 2015. More detainees are held without charge or trial. And as I told you, there are like in Israel has issued more than 50,000 administrative detention orders, and 24 of which were issued between the year of 2000 and 2014. These are pictures of the arrest of students from the demonstrations that is being held against the Israeli occupation. So finally, I want to talk because you are like you are considered as foreign students, right? Like if for us as Palestinians, if you want to come and study in Palestine, like how many of you want to come and like visit Palestine or study in Palestine, help us make some research or something, please.
Okay. Yeah, for instance, if you can talk about, can you as a professor and American professor, an American citizen, go and teach at Berzeit this University or not?
Okay, that's what I'm gonna talk about. So not only Palestinians have restrictions on their education and the violations towards their education from the Israeli occupation, but also because of these, all the violations that we explained, we have a localized knowledge in Palestine, where we try, like Palestine have only 5% of illiteracy, and it's the highest education level we have in the region. It's in Palestine, in the Middle East. But we are trying to have our education as a resistance tool against the occupation. But also, even despite all the obstacles, but even when we are having that, we have a localized knowledge because we have we, like foreign students can come and study in Birzeit University or Bethlehem University or Al-Quds University or any other Palestinian university until they are being issued a visa for 3 months only, a tourist visa, not a student visa, for 3 months from the Israeli occupation. So they can issue, let's say, what's your name again?
Saad.
Okay, Saad, you want to come to Palestine and study, like in my university, there is a program called Palestinian Arabic Studies. It's for foreign students. So you applied, you got accepted, and welcome to Palestine. And you need to apply for a visa for 3 months. They will give you the tourist visa. It's not tourist, you're not a tourist yet. After going back from Palestine, you will be a tourist and you will be banned forever from coming back to Palestine. But they don't issue a work visa. They issue only a tourist visa for 3 months. And we have a 5 month semester. So how are you going to study in our schools? Even for the professors, we have only two foreign for my university, only two foreign professors, and they have been like in Palestine like in for, since 70s, because they are living in Palestine, they got married in Palestine, that's it. Like any foreign professor that wants to come to Palestine and teach, they can't, because they have to have a work visa, right? And they will not issue that. Actually, there are like many Palestinians who live in diaspora. They don't have, they never returned to Palestine. And they are like, for example, living in the U.S., they were born and raised in the U.S., they don't have the Palestinian ID, but they want to come back to Palestine and give back, like, to their community, to the Palestinians. So, unfortunately, these are being mostly denied from entry, and if they got entry, they will have the tourist visa for 3 months, and our semester is 5 months. So we have, like, now nearly... I think 10 to 15 Palestinian professors who were living in the diaspora, but they are being deported back to the country that they were living in because the Israeli side didn't renew their visa, their tourist visa. So all that like makes us like we have a recycled knowledge, because all the knowledge that we get is from professors that attended the local Palestinian universities and then got graduated, got their PhD, then get back to the university, give us their like knowledge that also that they got from this local university. So we are trying. Thank God that we have internet. Like, thank God for the internet and technology, because now we have some access to other people, and we have been trying to build bridges with other universities, enter a new curricula, but that's not the answer. Like, that's not a solution. We need to have a full right, not pieces of the rights. So that's how the border, the visa looks like, the permit. It's all in Hebrew and some in English, and yes. So basically, that's for someone who has been like, luckily he has been like issued for.
What is that? This is an exit permit from the state of Israel.
Yeah, exactly. So this is for a professor that is living in Palestine and has been issued for a visa for several years. But and at any time, from out of Palestine, that he wants to come back, even if he have a visa, also they can deny him entry. And some we have some friends that they got a visa to come to Palestine. They got involved in research in Palestine for 3 months. Then they got back, and they after two years they wanted to come back to Palestine and do the same research.
and develop it. And unfortunately, they told them that they are banned from entry to Palestine for the next 10 years. Some of them for the next 5 years, only because they are being in solidarity with Palestinians and being pro-Palestinians. So, next slide.
Oh, I always forget.
Okay. So basically why we are here. So we are not here to, I know that you are all feel sympathy with us, because any human being that will hear about the Palestinian stories, not only me and Arij's story, but also the Palestinian stories that they read about or they watch in, through the media or the social media, can feel sympathy with Palestinians' cause. But we are not here to have your sympathy. We are here to have your solidarity. Because we are, as students, we are connecting with you from student to student level. Because we think that we are the future of the of our countries. So we are here to connect with you from student to student level, and from human being to human being, because we believe that we are the change of our realities. And if any one of you like try think about like any simple change towards our cause as Palestinians, then something will be changed, because raising awareness about our cause, about the injustice that we are facing, is really important, and that will help building a community that knows about Palestine and being in solidarity with Palestine. And in this way, we can put pressure on the governments that help Israel to continue the occupation of our land. So we hope and we believe that our staying here as Palestinians, we have been like for the first time in our lives, we have been feeling free. When we go back home to Palestine, we'll not be free. We will be like sieged, and this is our first time feeling free. So for you guys to have all that freedom, you are lucky, and we hope that you will help us and be in solidarity with us to get our freedom and to be full human, basically, with equal rights. And I'm gonna let Arij finish the presentation, and thank you for listening to us.
Sonos basically said it all. I think it's time that we move on from sympathy to solidarity, because we have had enough sympathy from the outside world, and we've been let down by so many countries, that it's time that we, as youth sitting here in this hall today, start making a change forward. And I do, I'm one of the people who believe that if each and every one of us today, if you guys today, goes and educates at least one person of your community about the stories and the struggles you have heard here today, imagine the kind of community we will be able to build based on solidarity with Palestinians. You guys might ask, you guys might tell yourself that I'm still a university student, there is nothing in my hand. I feel sad for the Palestinian people, but I can't do anything. This is completely wrong, because you as a student studying today and receiving your full education in American universities, you should know that you are lucky, and there is a lot in your hands, and there is a lot you can do. One of these options is the BDS campaign, which you can join, and you can help in supporting the Palestinian economy instead of supporting the Israeli one. This is one option. Other option is educating people around you about the Palestinian cause. Only if we pressure Israel. Now, Israel is not going to wake up one day and say, we feel bad for the Palestinian people, we should end the occupation. Only if we pressure the Israeli occupation, that we will be able to end it, and we will be able to get our freedom one day. don't do this for me, don't do this for Sindus, do it for Ahmad Manasra, do it for Muhammad Abu Khadir, do it for Shuruq Dwekat, a girl from my university who was shot in the chest 3 months ago on her way to university. Shuruq did not die that day, but she's still being convicted in Israeli prisons of trying to stab an Israeli settler on her way to pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Do it for those people. Do it for the children who are still being deprived of their education each and every day. Do it for the people who are being humiliated and being discriminated against each and every day at Qalandia checkpoint, at Beit Lahem checkpoint, and at the other 500 checkpoints that are spread inside the West Bank. Do it for those people, and I do believe that each and everyone sitting in this room today can make a change, as little as it was. Thank you guys for listening. If you have any questions, we'll be more than glad to answer you.